the alcoholic who still suffers. To pursue this work, Valley Group field agents search the western states for the finest recovery speakers to come and share their message of experience, strength, and hope with them. Each week, a single speaker is chosen from the many for their service to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And now, Valley Group World Headquarters is proud to announce the winner of the Outstanding Speaker of the Week. The nominee for this category has a sobriety date of 7/27 of 2010. She has been in continuous service as an archivist on the H&I panel for Fresno First, is the memorabilia and co-bylaws chair for Action Club, the Young People's in AA, and is active also as an AA sponsor, taking people through the 12 steps. She does not have an AA motto, but I'm sure you're figuring out during her pitch. Now, may I have the envelope, please?
But you're hot. And And I took some ibuprofen and I drank some Gatorade and nothing helped. And I just went, screw it, I'm going to drink a beer. And I did, and I felt so much better. And I think that was the first time I really got relief from alcohol. That was when it really showed me its magic for the first time. Fast forward a few years, I lived with my dad who had gone back out, and that was when my everyday drinking started, because my dad would drink every day and it was always in the house, and so that's like the picture of the beginning of alcoholism. I drank every day because I couldn't, because it was there. And my dad was my drinking buddy. And he was a lot of fun when he got drunk. He was Mr. Moneybags and wanted to, like, take me to the casino or let's go to the bar and drink where it's more fun. And like many good alcoholic relationships, the shit hit the fan. And I brought this guy over to have a book study or something. So that's not true. Anyway, so my dad tried to stab the guy, and so I had to move out. So living with my mom, it was a little bit trickier to drink at my mom's house because my mom was my dad's Al-Anon for so long and saw so much of the ugly part of alcoholism that she didn't even let it in her house. And so then that was really the only time that I ever had to, that I ever really had to sneak alcohol. And that's, like, that sentence right there, that's something that you're not going to ever hear somebody who's not an alcoholic say. That was the only time I had to sneak alcohol. Had to. I had to. when I moved out of my mom's house, I moved straight in with a guy that was needing a place to live because he was just getting out of his halfway house. So we did a lot of really great drinking together and decided to have a baby. The day I found out I was pregnant, I was drunk when I found out I was pregnant. And so I immediately stopped drinking. And then the next day I couldn't say stop. And I think that was the point that I realized that I didn't have a hold of this thing anymore. And I knew what alcoholism was. I did. And I was a smart girl. I went to nursing school. I can spell any freaking word in the dictionary. I know what alcohol does to a baby, to an unborn baby. I had all these really, really big, important reasons that I shouldn't drink anymore. But it just wasn't possible. I couldn't not drink. And every day I woke up with a firm resolution not to do that again. And every day I did. And I drank every day that I was pregnant with my second baby. Every day. The horsemen, the fear and the remorse and the horror, I think there's another one, I don't know what it is, shout it out if you know it. Bewilderment. I felt those things in labor. I was in the hospital in labor. And I was just feeling all of those things. Having a baby should be like this wonderful, joyous thing. Like, you should be so filled up with love. Well, in labor, like, pain is a big feeling. But but love and excitement and anticipation, and I was completely filled with just horror and fear and remorse and bewilderment. I was terrified that as soon as he came out, everybody would know. Everybody would know what I had done to this baby. And the thing that I knew, the most prominent thing that I knew about fetal alcohol syndrome was that their ears are real tiny. And so I was just waiting for them to say that something was wrong. I knew it was coming. And the kid came out, and I swear to God, it was like the movie Dumbo, like his ears flopped one at a time, flop.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still as big as satellites. Like, he could get ESPN radio with those things, and he's 4.5. I don't think he'll grow into them. And at that point, I knew that this magnificent, like, beautiful creature had survived me, you know? Like, he wasn't, like, carried, you know, all snugly and safely in my womb the way that a baby should be inside of his mom. He barely got out alive. And I knew that the fact that he was healthy and perfect had nothing to do with me. At that point, I didn't know why he was healthy and perfect, and I didn't know who saved him from me, but I just knew that he had survived, and I was thankful for that. When I got home from the hospital, you know, 2.5 days later, however long they make you stay, with my, you know, I had my firm resolution the whole time I was in the hospital not to drink anymore. And I stopped at the liquor store on my way home and got a bunch of 40s. And it, you know, right there in the car seat, in the car with me, I had every reason in the world not to walk into that freaking liquor store. And it just defies logic. I'm sure you guys know. My baby was born in June of 2008. During this time that I was a functioning alcoholic, my brother was not a functioning alcoholic. He was homeless and in and out of jail, had lost his girlfriend, had lost his best friend. And he was 2 years younger than me. We were really, really close. And this is, you know, this is when I knew what alcoholism was, but I hadn't read the big book, you know, like I didn't know how to help. And so we all, my whole family told him over and over, like, you can stay with us, you just can't drink here. You can stay at my house, you just can't drink here. I had a huge house, and I had, like, the mother-in-law's den in the back, and, it, like, he could have had his own studio apartment, so then we can't drink here. And so he slept on the boxes behind food rack. And on September 24th of 2008, 3 months after this child escaped me alive, my mom got a phone call from the sheriff that my brother was dead. And what happened was the night before, he was, like, at 3 or 4 in the morning, he was walking, it was cold, he looked homeless, and so the police stopped and ran his ID, and he had a bench warrant. And I was really angry. I was really angry at the police for a long time over the death of my brother. But the peace that I found is that they didn't have to take him in that night. It was cold, and he was skinny. Yeah, he was always a skinny guy. He was like 6'2", and he weighed like 180. Just really skinny. He was homeless, and it was cold, and they didn't have to take him somewhere that was warm with food to eat, and they did. In his backpack, he had 3 empty, you know, like giant vodka bottles. And he went to jail, and he didn't have anything else to drink. And he didn't actually start drinking until he was 20, because he knew about my dad, and he knew about our grandpa, and he didn't want to turn out like them. And so he was 22 when this all happened. It was like 2 weeks before his 23rd birthday. So he went to jail. He didn't have anything else to drink. He got incredibly, incredibly sick, and he had a seizure in jail. He had a cellmate who knew CPR and started CPR, and by the time he got to the hospital, he was dead. And that was after less than 3 years of drinking. And I saw, you know, I saw what it did to my mom, and I saw what it did to my dad, and I knew that he was my only brother, and I knew that my kids would never know their uncle who loved them so much. And it just tore up my whole family. And so I went home, and I drowned it with food, because that's what alcoholics do. And it just wasn't, like, it killed my brother, and it wasn't a good enough reason. It just wasn't. I married the guy that moved in with me, fresh out of the halfway house, and that relationship was dripping in alcohol, and he did a lot of meth, and so I thought that he was worse than me. And I even tried meth a couple of times. I got drunk enough for it to seem like a good idea, and that's how I know I'm an actual real alcoholic. They talk about how addictive meth is, and how it's like you try it once and you're hooked. And I hated that shit because it made me feel sober. It wasn't for me. So the marriage that was dripping in poison got abusive, and I left a couple of times, but I knew that I wasn't done drinking, and I knew that nobody else was going to go to work and support me and all my bowl and all my drinking, and so I always went back. The day that I got sober is the day that I left him, and it was, I didn't wake up that morning and go, I think I'm going to go to AA and find a higher power. I woke up and drank, and then the kid that survived me, I gave him a haircut, from what I understand, but I only know that because the clippers were out and there was hair all over the backyard. I don't have really any recollection of it. And I went back to sleep. Not, I passed out again. And before I passed out, I called my cousin who lived 4 doors down, and I said, can you watch my kids? I don't feel good. I'm really, really sick. And little did I know how very, very true that actually was. But she was like, yeah, of course. And I don't know if I took them over there, or if she came and got them, or if they just went on their own. You know, I forgot to mention that somewhere in there I gained 3 more kids. Somebody saw fit that I should be a legal guardian of these kids whose dad had died, and so at this time I had 5 kids. So I think that the likely story is that my kids just went over to my cousin's house after I passed out, and my cousin figured out what was going on and called my mom. My sobriety date, July 27th, 2010, is my little sister's 22nd birthday. She is 5 years younger than me, and she is one of the most important people in my life, and during my drinking, I had completely let go of that relationship, and she was going to college, and I didn't even know what for. You know, she lived in the same city as me, and I hardly saw her. And so this day, on her birthday, she had to rescue me. She didn't have to. She chose to spend her special day saving my ass and saving my kids. And her and my mom went to my cousin's house, and they got my kids, and they took them back to my mom's house, and then they came back to my apartment. And this part I didn't know until weeks later, but they dumped out all the alcohol that they found, which was a lot, which is fascinating to me because I don't even remember going to the store. Y'all familiar with that feeling? The, like, magic reappearing alcohol? And I woke... Oh, and they also took all my money out of my wallet. I didn't know that until weeks later. So my mom, like, shook me awake somehow and told me that my cousin was going to take me to a meeting at 6:30. And the actual words that came out of my mouth were, "Oh, thank God." Like, I knew at that point that I couldn't do this anymore. I knew how my brother died, and I knew how I was going to die. And it was, in that moment, it was that perfectly clear that I wouldn't survive myself like my child did. And, you know, promptly 6:30, my cousin came over and put my clothes on me because I couldn't do it by myself. And she took me to a women's meeting on Millbrook and Alluvial. And I don't remember a word that was said. I don't remember anything. But I remember the women just looking at me like they understood. And I was a hot mess. It was the end of July in Fresno. It was like hell. And I was sweaty, and I don't know when's the last time I had showered. And I was crying the whole time. And I just remember them looking at me like, it wasn't like pity, and they weren't grossed out. They were like, "Holy shit, I've been there." Like that kind of look. And I kept going to that meeting, that women's meeting, and it was only on Monday and Tuesday night, and I didn't know what I was going to do, like Wednesday through Sunday, and my mom and my cousin and my sister really, like, pulled it together and found me a meeting to go to almost every day the first couple of weeks, and they took me, and they brought me home, and they gave me directions so that I could go. And my mom gave me a solid 2 weeks of, like, rehabilitating, where she didn't, like, me and my kids moved in with her, and she didn't really make me do anything for, like, the first 2 weeks. And I think it was because I looked and felt like crap, and at the end of the second week, she kind of pulled my covers and said, like, get your ass in the shower and take care of your kids. And that was it. And I hit the ground running. I got a sponsor at that women's meeting. Her name was Barb. And what happened was I went to a different women's meeting, and they asked if there were any burning desires, and I heard about sponsorship. And, you know, like, I knew my dad's sponsor from way back. His name's Ron. And he curses like a sailor. And he drives a really old red truck that's in here, like from a mile away. And so I knew that people in AA had sponsors. And I knew that there were steps. And I knew about the hand swinging at the end of the prayer. So I went to this different women's meeting, and I raised my hand for the burning desire, and I said, I feel like I'm treading water. I feel like I'm okay. I'm okay right now because I can tread water for a while. But I also feel like I need to move in some direction or eventually I'm going to drown. You can't tread water forever. You can do it for a long time, but not forever. And this lady named Karen W., who I love all the way from the tips of my toes to my hair, is lovely and wonderful, and she talked to me after the meeting, and she gave me her card, and it said, one day at a time, Karen Williams, Karen W., and it had her phone number on it, and she said, I can't sponsor you. I just don't have any room in my schedule. I wish I could, but I just can't. She was like, what I want you to do is I want you to go to your women's meeting, and at the end of every meeting, I want you to raise your hand and say, I need a sponsor. And I want you to call me every day that you do that until you get a sponsor. And then I want you to call me and tell me that you have a sponsor. And I said, okay. It was like, now I have instructions. Like, before I didn't have instructions, and now somebody's given me a to-do list, and so I can do this. And it was, you know, it was simple. And simple but not easy. It's not easy when you're new to raise your hand and say, I need help. It's a simple, simple instruction. It is not easy to do. I did it, and this lady Barb became my sponsor it was like a blind date. It was like through a series of phone calls. Somebody said, I know someone who would be perfect for you. And Barb was really great for a little while. And then I was sitting in a meeting one day that she was supposed to meet me at. And I got a text from her, and it said, my life is shit right now. I'm not guiding you as well as you should be guided. I need you to ask somebody else to sponsor you. And my world crumbled. How could she do this to me? I was so sad. And I decided out of a resentment to never go back to that meeting that I used to meet her at. And instead, I started going to this other fellowship called Home Group Fellowship. And the things in sobriety that turn out to be a blessing in disguise are plentiful. The Home Group Fellowship is where I met the sponsor that I have now. Her name is Terry. And I feel like it's like a true meeting of the soul. Like she is my perfect match. So I asked her one of her friends named Tiffany, I'm looking for a sponsor, and she said, oh, Terry's a good one to ask. I think you'll like her a lot. And I said, do you think she'll say yes? And she was like, yeah, I think so. And so the next time I saw Terry at a meeting, she actually chaired the meeting, and we alcoholics are selfish and self-centered. And I was sure that she knew, because she was looking at me funny, you know? And I sat there so nervous through the whole meeting that she was chairing. And at the end of the meeting, I walked up to her and I said, so I'm looking for a sponsor, and I heard you're a good one to ask. And she said, oh, so nice. Are you asking me to be your sponsor? I said, oh, yeah, I'm asking, can you please be my sponsor? She said, yeah, of course I will. And that was like the longest 3.5 second pause of my life. She told me to read from the cover to page 164 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a book that was written a really, really long time ago. And so it was pretty dry reading my first time around. And so this was like my method to get through all these freaking pages she wanted me to read before she would take me through the steps, is that I would read a little bit in what I liked, or what I used to like to call the boring part. And then once I like found myself drifting, I would flip back and read a story, because those are like action-packed. So I'd read a story and then I'd flip back to the boring part and I'd read until I got bored and then I'd read an action-packed story again. And so when I got through the front of the book through page 164, I called her and she, we got together and we started sitting together every other Thursday. So the very first Thursday that we met, it was at McDonald's. The second Thursday that we met, she said, I'm going to pick you up, and we're going to go to a meeting from 6 to 7, and then we're going to go to my house and do step work. And I said, okay. And I was like 5 months over, probably, four to five. And so we go, she picks me up, and we go to this meeting, she called it, and we walk in, and there are rows of women, and then there's a row of seats facing all the women, and she like sits in this row facing all the women, and I'm like, what the fuck is going on? What am I supposed to do? And she's like, you sit right next to me. This is a Nation I panel. You need to be in service. You're starting now. Whoa. And I didn't say anything. And she said, it was fine. You just be on the panel. And I didn't say anything for probably the first 3 months we were there. And then I finally caught up to it was a book study H&I panel. And so when I was doing my step work with her, I finally caught up to the place that they were in the book at the H&I panel, and then I felt like, I don't know, capable, or I had something to say. And I have been on that panel for the last 2 years and 3 months. One of the girls that used to be there, I saw at another meeting, and she asked me to be her sponsor, and I've been sponsoring her since I was just a little over a year sober, and we have a wonderful friendship also. I think I skipped a lot of stuff. So the thing that my sponsor does for the second step was something we call the spiritual terms exercise. And I grew up with no spiritual or religious influence at all. I didn't have my dad was super anti-Catholic because his parents were like super devout Catholic, and my mom was just kind of hippie. She was like, cool, God and stuff. And so I didn't have, like, we didn't go to church and we didn't pray. When we lived in Los Angeles, across the street from my grandma, we had to go to Mass on Easter and Christmas, or we wouldn't be, like, recognized as grandchildren. But that was my, that was my exposure to church. And so in the second step, I felt like I was lacking something. Like everybody that I talked to seemed to have experience and, you know all these like passages and stuff from the Bible and you know, knew like I know there's a guy in the Bible named Moses. I know his name. Like I don't know anything about the story of a guy named Moses. I just know there's a Moses in the Bible. And people would like, you know, people would talk about these stories and they'd go, you know, the story about Peter and la la la, and everybody would go, oh yeah, huh? And I'd be like, oh yeah, huh? And I felt like it was a real liability that I didn't have any of that exposure. And going through the spiritual terms exercise and asking myself what a higher power was to me and what I wanted to give my will and my life to, and finding something that I understood as much as I needed to, was really super easy for me. I didn't have a prejudice. I didn't have a resentment. I didn't have anything that I needed to get over before I could start trusting this thing. I just had to get to know it. And I found that to be a wonderful thing. In step three, she actually had me get on my knees and say a prayer. And that was completely foreign to me. And it was the third step prayer. And I kind of did it like every night after that to get comfortable with praying. And I, you know, I knew the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer. And the third step prayer is in the big book. And I was like, ooh, another prayer that I can memorize. Because it wasn't something that came naturally to me. The fourth step, the big, bad, ugly inventory is not big, bad, or ugly. No, it's not bad or ugly. Sometimes it's big. I heard everybody say all these scary things about the inventory, and it's a searching and fearless moral inventory, and I went into it fearful because of the reputation that it has. And my sponsor told me something very helpful, and that was when you're starting your fourth step work, anytime you're in the fourth step, when you're starting it, you pray. You pray to be shown these things that belong on your inventory. And she told me that a very important part, as far as she was concerned, was to pray when you were done. And that makes sense to me. Like, you're praying to be shown all these ugly, dark things about yourself. It makes sense that you would pray when you're done to get out of this ugly, dark place. And that became a really important part of inventory for me in the fourth step, in the tenth step, in the 11th step. It's something that you use over and over and over. This damn inventory. In the fifth step, when you share all your goals with your sponsor, I told her right away. I told her at the very beginning, as soon as I asked her to be my sponsor, I told her I drank my entire pregnancy. I just need to put that out there so that I'm not afraid to tell you anything. This is the ugliest thing I've ever done. And now I can tell you anything. The reason that I'm up here saying this into a microphone, and I know it's being recorded, is that I didn't get to go to as many meetings as I wanted to with five kids in the beginning of sobriety. I thought I should be at a meeting every night because it was where I felt safe in the beginning of sobriety. And I listened to a lot of speaker tapes because I couldn't go to a lot of meetings. And I was fresh out of that ugly, abusive, like, alcohol-ridden relationship. I didn't even want to look at men. And so I didn't want to hear about their problems and get their advice and shake their hands. And so I listened to only women's speaker tapes. And there there was a tape where a woman talked about, there's just, it was so important to me to hear those things. There was a woman who talked about going to the beach and drinking in a bar that was on a pier, and one of her kids fell into the ocean and died. And she said this on a speaker tape. She was recorded saying this at some conference somewhere for all the world of Alcoholics Anonymous to hear. And it was important for me to hear those dirty, ugly things because I knew a lot of men that drank just like me. I met a lot of men that could almost keep up with me drinking. I drank at pool halls and biker bars, and I drank with a lot of men who drank just like me. I didn't know any women who could keep up with me, and I didn't know any women who had done the things that I had done. And so listening to those speaker tapes was life-changing for me, because I knew that there's nothing that I've done that nobody else has done. Absolutely nothing. If you think you're the first, I'm sorry, you're not. So my fifth step with my sponsor, there was a lot of crying and telling her all my dirty ugly. And then there's a really important part of the fifth step that I think sometimes gets skipped. And it is that after you do your fifth step, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything, for we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? So, when you do the fifth step with your sponsor, it's not over. A part of the fifth step is quietly reflecting on whether you've left anything out. And I don't know if I mentioned this already, but I have 5 freaking kids. So I went to the parking lot at Burger King and sat in my car. It's the only quiet place in my life. And reviewed everything. And there were a few things that I had left out. I met her again and we went over that stuff, and then she sent me on my merry way to do steps 6 and 7, and it was the first time that I was doing steps all by myself without my sponsor there. And there's a paragraph in the big book about step 6 and a paragraph about step 7, and I wanted to be okay. And I wanted to be thorough, so I did those out of the 12 and 12, and it was incredibly, I did them out of the 12 and 12 at the water park while the kids played, and it was, it lightened me. It felt lighter because of it. My amends were easy, but they don't ever end. You're never done with your amends. You just get to keep doing them because we're alcoholics and we screw stuff up. It's a wonderful thing that we have amends and we can just keep doing them and fixing the things that we've broken. They don't stay broken. Continue to step 10, the personal inventory. I do 10 step calls all the time. I do 10 step calls when I'm thinking about something screwed up. I call my sponsor and say, I'm thinking something screwed up, and I tell her about it, and she goes, well, at least you didn't open your mouth, now you don't have to make an amend. So that's a great thing. There's a lot of writing for step 11. I'm not great at praying in the morning, I'm not a morning person, I'm barely human, but I do pray at night, and sometimes I write a little bit, I'm not going to lie, like twice a week, maybe once a week. And step 12, practicing these principles in all of our affairs. I am a much, much better mom than I used to be. I am not perfect. I don't even have like a whole day where I'm perfect. But I think that my children's lives are bearable because of AA and because of God. It's nothing that I did. Carrying this message to alcoholics, I hope that I have just done that. And I'm out of time, so I'm going to be quiet.